My name is Jennifer Tischler, and I'm the Associate Director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, also known as CRECA. And we're pleased that today's presentation is being sponsored jointly by the UW-Madison Mossy Weinstein Center for Jewish Studies and the community organization Madison Vilnius Sister Cities. A couple of housekeeping announcements before we start today's presentation. Please do sign in. There's a sign-up sheet circulating if you're already on our mailing list. You do not need to give us any information other than your name, but if you'd like to join our mailing list or if you have new information to share, please do give us your email contact information. A couple of announcements on upcoming events. Tomorrow, previews for The Dragon begin. This is a play that's being put on by UW-Madison Theater for Youth. It's part of a course being taught by Manon Vandewater and Jen Plants, based on a Russian play, a fairy tale written in the 1940s, but this is the English adaptation. And it will be on at the Memorial Union Frederick March Play Circle starting next Tuesday. Tickets are available online or at the box office. You save a little bit in fees if you buy your tickets from the box office rather than using the online system. So I do recommend that. It's going to be a good production. And then next week's talk back here in room 206 on Thursday, October 27th, is The Balkans as a Discursive Geography and a Method for Liminal Space. So today we are very pleased to welcome to CRECA our colleague from UW-Eau Claire, Harry Joel, Professor of Geography. If I could editorialize a minute or to personalize it, I first learned of Professor Joel's research thanks to an interview that ran on Wisconsin Public Radio this summer, and I was so excited to hear about the story. Professor Joel and his team had recently returned from Lithuania, where they had used ground-penetrating radar to find a passageway constructed by Jewish prisoners in World War II to escape from a Nazi camp in Lithuania. So I listened to the broadcast in the 4 o'clock hour and then waited for WPR to rerun the story in the 5 o'clock hour so I could hear it again. Later that evening, Professor Herrera sent me a link to the story, so then I realized I didn't have to wait to hear it the second time. But be that as it may, Professor Joel has come to Madison to talk about his recent work in Lithuania. Joel has a PhD from the University of Calgary and held two postdoctoral fellowships before joining the faculty at UW-Eau Claire, where he is now a professor and a fellow of the Geological Society of America. During his doctoral research through to the present, he has utilized ground-penetrating radar, GPR, at more than 1,000 sites all over the world, and Professor Joel has a broad background in the earth sciences, particularly geomorphology and geoarchaeology. So please join me in welcoming Harry Joel.
Well, thank you very much for the invite, and this morning I was grading lab exams, giving lab exams, and hit traffic coming down here on I-94. But I'm very happy to be here. It's always good to come down to Madison. University of Minnesota is a lot closer to me, so I'm really over there. But what I want to do today is tell you stories, and as I get more and more, science communication is very important. I was just at the Geological Society of America meeting, and we had a discussion there among many different colleagues there about moving into the non-factual age and the idea of how do we use facts today and do we need facts to substantiate stories and things like that. And part of what I'm trying to do today is talk about some of the science that we're trying to put out there. I was going to show this. We have a couple technical difficulties just getting this up and running. I use similar systems, but it's always a little touchy on if it's going to go. Corey Flintoff came up with NPR and came afterwards with Wisconsin Public Radio, and he was over from Russia and was very interested in this story, and he interviewed us, and that sparked a lot of interest that we'll talk about a little later on as we go through. And this is part of a much larger story. I'm just one part of the story. I'm working with Richard Freund. He's a director of Judaic Studies at University of Hartford. Philip Reeder, who's at Duquesne University. John Seligman, who's director of research and permitting of the Israeli Antiquities Authority. Montas Darbas from the Lithuanian Institute of Research, and then two colleagues I've worked with for a long time, Paul and Alistair, who are at Worley Parsons, now remorphed into AdVision. And we've worked in a variety of different sites around the world. This is very much a student project. There's a lot of students involved in this. On the left-hand side is students that I've brought along. Some have paid them their own way. Some involved in a program that I'll mention briefly, as well as individuals from the University of Hartford, Brandeis University, as well as others in Lithuania. This is a group of students that were involved in this past summer, involved in everything that you will see in this program. So this is undergraduate students. Jackie here, she's just presented at the West Lakes, East Lakes Association American Geographers Conference in Marquette. I just drove down from there on Sunday, and she took first place on some of the research that you'll see here on her poster. And so this is very much getting undergraduates with real research, original research in these areas. We have a lot of partners, a lot of different organizations that we work with around in Lithuania, but on different locations around the world. And we're always looking for more partners, more funding opportunities, and funders in these situations. And so the big one, the Vilnius-Gaon State Jewish Museum, is at the two of the sites. When I said which sections of our research should I talk about, those two sites are particularly the Vilnius-Gaon State Jewish Museum, because they basically control or run a lot of those sites in these regions. I have to acknowledge a variety of different funding agencies. I'll talk about the International Fellows Program at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire a little later. The United States Commission for the Preservation of America's Heritage Abroad, essentially the State Department, funded our first year going. And I'll talk about why that happened. The Maurice Greenberg Center for Genetic Studies is where Richard Freund is, Bayer School of Natural and Environmental Science. Duquesne is where Phil Reeder is coming from. And then our foundation at the university has also helped to sponsor some students along the way. I'm going to start off with the science right at the front end, some of the ground-penetrating radar methodology. I have to be very careful when I come to Madison, because GPR here means general purpose revenue. And I have to be clear right off the bat that we're talking about ground-penetrating radar. I gave a talk to the Regents years ago, and they were what are we talking about, GPR? And they didn't understand it was scientific methods in those areas. And then I'm going to tell a story of how I got involved in this with a lot of 20 years of research to where we are now and where we want to go into the future. And then concentrate on two sites of the Great Synagogue in Schulf of Vilnia, and then the Ponar extermination camp. And it's really, I use that term extermination camp. It's not like the extermination camps, let's say, of Poland. It's quite different. And we'll talk about those as we go through. And then make some summary comments at the end there. So what is GPR? It's ground penetrating radar. It's a tool that's been around for a while. If you listen to your radio, I was listening to NPR on the way down, in different areas, 88.9, 100 megahertz, you have that meter long or 3 foot long antennae on your car. You're listening to the FM radio waves. I use those electromagnetic waves, the same ones, and I put those into the ground. And I'm putting those waves into the ground and waiting for those echoes to come back. And I'm trying to image the stratigraphy or the layering in the subsurface, be it the natural surfaces, what I'm trained in as a physical geographer, or be it archaeological features in the subsurface. And my background is coming from the earth sciences and working with archaeologists to take a look at those. And so when we take a look at these sites, we can see that we are in the FM radio range here. And that we are similar to that as the TV radio range. Our eyes, as you can see in the colors that we're seeing around us, has a very, very narrow bandwidth in the electromagnetic radiation. There's much more that we can look at the world at than just the electromagnetic radiation of what we see with our eyes. And so we're trying to use those tools to look into the subsurface. Where did this start? It was from the Apollo lunar modules. When that module was coming down and was going to land on the moon, they had developed ground-penetrating radar to see if that module was actually going to stop, if it was going to keep on going. They had the reverse thrusters ready to go to take that back up. And now we know we can land on the moon, we can put people on the moon, but it was that ground-penetrating radar technology was part of why we could land on that moon. And from there, it became commercial availability on there. And so what we are doing is we're sending a wave into the ground, and it's coming back up to that antennae. And we can see if we move that antennae along the surface, we can start imaging into the ground and seeing the layers or seeing artifacts into the subsurface. This is the way I look in the field. I'm usually working on Lake Superior or Lake Michigan or some other coastlines around the world. But essentially what we have is an antennae that transmit those signals into the ground. We're using fiber optic cables to talk back to the backpack here in this case. And I'm seeing what you're going to see today real time. And this talk has very much evolved. This is literally, as we're talking right now, there are people flying back to Lithuania to excavate some of the sites you're going to see today. And so this is real-time things happening as we're going through. We're using a system from Sensors and Software out of Toronto, Canada. There are basically three systems around the world. This is a Pulse Echo 100 and 1000. I've been using a similar system since I was doing my PhD work. And so very familiar with this system. I take a look at these profiles, and you're going to see several of these, and I just want to orient yourself. Up on the left-hand side is usually time. This is a time-based technique. And so we know how long these waves come and go down and come back up. Across the top will often be distance in meters, and then around on the side will often be depth measurements, and in this case, it's 5 meters. And these profiles take time to interpret, and I need to work with people to understand these. So for example, I see some horizontal layering here in yellow, and then I can see a red line here that's dipping, and I could talk a little bit more in detail very objectively, but this to me means that something has eroded back into this landscape and eroded into those horizontal layers in this area. And then we have some basically horizontal layering going on here, subhorizontal, and then we have some more dipping reflections here, and then some more dipping reflections, but at a less steep angle. And for me as a geomorphologist looking at a coastal landscape, this says everything about storms on Lake Superior. But I could take a look at the rivers of Wisconsin River where we've worked as well, and this could be the bars in the river moving and eroding into those landscapes. So until you know the context, it becomes a problem. And so this we try to remain as objective because this could be the result of boom, and all of a sudden, as you can see, a dinosaur in the subsurface. And it just doesn't work that way because the subsurface is complicated. Natural processes are complicated. We know some things just don't reflect. Some ground absorbs all those signals. And then you add humans into the equation and it becomes all that more complex. And so we're trying to understand the context of those subsurface and what's going on, both from a natural process, but also when humans upset these processes. And that's where I try to work in these areas, because the actual object may be a wall in a synagogue, but from the radar perspective is what I see on the bottom. And I have to be able to transfer what we see in the subsurface to pass that along to the archaeologists who have to make a decision of tens of thousands of dollars to change where we're going to excavate these sites and transfer those across. So I'm going to take you back to how we originally got this team going. We do a fair amount of biblical archaeology work in Israel, and we have been to, you know, literally 20, 25 sites around Israel. We started a lot of our work in Bethsaida and taking a look as a base of operations here, a community that was trying to prove where Bethsaida was located. And still to this day, if you read Biblical Archaeology Review, there's a huge debate. 20 years after we made this an open shut case, another organization was just funded to take a look at another location. So we're going to go back next summer and try to sort this out again. We just found some tunnels at these sites. Tunnels have become quite important in a lot of archaeological areas as we figure out in our own country about borders. Should we build walls? Should we not build walls? Where's the tunnels? We can go to Israel. We can take a look at the same areas. These are recurring themes into history as well. People are trying to escape from areas. That was all set up in a larger project looking at the Cave of Letters in the Judean Desert. This was filmed by NOVA and part of the science communication of trying to get out how we can use science to solve some of these issues in history. And we were privileged to be able to go into the cave with permitting and excavate as well. I did ground penetrating radar to direct where the archaeologists would dig. And so that's a whole other story that we could get into. From there, we moved to Qumran. We looked at a lot of cave sites, and we looked at graves. and graves are of essence. How many graves are there? What are their orientations? And we imaged or mapped every single grave at that location. And the big one that stood out was Tomb 1000. And just to show you what I take a look at in the subsurface is, I see these layering. I take a look at Qumran as an old lake deposit. It is an old lake deposit from 12 to 15,000 years ago, of which Qumran is built on top of. And so when I take a look in the subsurface, I am seeing these horizontal layering beds. And I could go up to Glacial Lake, Wisconsin, and see the similar bedding in these areas. But when I start seeing disturbances in the subsurface, and I just highlighted these with blue, and then I take a look at this again as I am collecting these data sets, something has happened into the subsurface. I go into 3D imagery, and I can see these plan views. This is like going into a CAT scan or an MRI, and they slice your body up. We're using the same software. We're now slicing up the ground, and I'm saying, hey, something is down here about 1.5 meters down, and we're seeing some potential materials in the subsurface. Could it be a body in the body buried there or not? That is not for me to decide. I give these sites, I pass them off, and they excavate the site digs later. There's a whole sub-story to this. But they excavated the site several days later. I'm off on the next site trying to locate different areas. And this led to the bones of contention. We found a whole prone body there, a first century jar, as well as you can see the rocks situated up here. And that's part of what we were imaging, as well as part of the body. Following Judaic law, we had to excavate from sun up to sundown, everything done in one day. And so that was a very challenging, long day. But we found a lot of materials on this at this site. From those sites, we've been able, because of the sensitivity, we're non-invasive, we're non-destructive, we've invited in to take a look inside the Western Wall. We've gone into the Kotels, into these areas, because we realize the sensitivity of these sites. And we can image inside here. We've worked at Yavne, which is home of Rabbinic Judaism, and looking into the subsurface here. Yavne Yam was its associated harbor. And we looked in there. Mary's Well has become very important recently. As we take a look at some of those areas, we found a major Christian mosaics about a meter, meter and a half below the surface. Again, we located some of these sites using radar, and those have been excavated over the past two summers. That continued this summer as well. We could work on coastlines, be it up on the coast or down on the coast, to take a look at some of these remains at these sites. And you can go all the way out to the desert and look for potential sites for Har Kokom or Mount Sinai, this one potential site, Har Kokom. We move from there, as we've developed our team, to Rhodes, Greece, and we're going, why Rhodes, Greece? Well, for a variety of different reasons, it's a fascinating site. In this area, we're put together our team here, again, students on the right-hand side, Richard Freund, Phil Reeder, and myself, as well as some others, in this area. And what we're interested in is some of the relationships with Jerusalem within Israel, but also to Rhodes. We got the Templars who've moved there. We also have a large Jewish community at this site. It was also one of these places with multiple harbors. And so people shipped a lot of things back and forth here. It's a beautiful medieval city if you have not been. It's a stunning location to take a look at. We also have one of the seven wonders of the world, the Colossus. And we were asked, can we find where the location of the Colossus was? It has a whole Jewish sub theme to it that's in there. These are part of the walls, the Byzantine walls that we've been looking for. We're continue these sites and basically passing these off to archaeologists. But as we took a look at these sites, the interest was in some of the Jewish synagogues. Rhodes had a strong Jewish populations. Probably one of the most dynamic, unique in Europe. You had a rabbinical college there. You had some famous schools for children at that site. And everything was going well until the 1930s, and then their passports documentation was stamped the Hebrew race at that site. And so what was a Judaic center now became a problem during the Second World War. The Allies were bombing the site. Most of the synagogues were bombed because that's where you would store a lot of your ammunitions and a lot of your supplies. And basically the end of the story is in July 23rd, 1944, that close to the end of the war, essentially all the Jews were rounded up here in Rhodes and were shipped off. And out of that, about 1,604 were killed during this time period. And if we take a look at Rhodes today, we've met basically the whole Jewish community. There's 4 to 10, depending on the day of the week, that are there and left in this region. We have a restored Kahal synagogue that we knew about before we went, and a list of names of individuals from this synagogue. And one of the questions of, could we come and take a look at the synagogue? What is the history? We have a long history that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years at this very dynamic site. Nowadays, many Jews will come up here for a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah or for a wedding at this site. It's very much a very active site in the summertime as we take a look at this. We have a memorial here, and so when we got on site here, these are some of the things that we were introduced in. Here's the synagogue. This is the Jewish community. We're coming up to Kahal Shalom. I had no idea American Express has 100 most endangered cultural sites in the world, but this is one of them. That has been funded for that restoration at these sites. This is the actual list of individuals from this synagogue who were killed in the synagogue, who were killed in the Second World War. And what we see here is we're inside the synagogue. We're working with the president of the synagogue. She's talking with Richard Freund here, along with the students on the right-hand side. And she says, you have full access to the work, what you need to do in here. This is a very unique synagogue. It has 2 Torah shrines, not one, like in many synagogues. We're trying to understand that, why that is occurring. At this site, Kos has a very similar one, and we're looking at going back there. But we had moved the pews around. We moved things around at this site so we could conduct ground-penetrating radar into the subsurface. We also worked, this is Kahal Grande, one of the largest synagogues in Rhodes. And what we can see here, it's completely destroyed. Allies bombed this site, but there is a lot of interest what's below the surface, because next to this they're excavating off on the left hand side here, they're excavating a church, and the idea is that there's a Roman road, and wouldn't it be interesting if there's a synagogue and a church next to each other? You go down the Roman road, you either go right or left into the synagogue, or you go into the Christian church there, living together during this time period. And that's what we're looking for in the subsurface as we take a look at. We're collecting data here. You can see the beam, what's left of the beam right here. We got the steps up to the Torah shrine. There's only one in this synagogue, while the other one had 2. So we're looking at some of the archaeological changes. And this is how we get to Lithuania. I'm giving a presentation at Batchelder Biblical Archaeology Conference in Omaha. John Seligman here is coming as a keynote speaker. And I'm talking about some of our research in Rhodes. And he's talking about some of his investigations in Lithuania, where he had just come back from taking a look at several different sites. And we talk after my talk and after his talk, and he says, Harry, do you think you could image along the surface of a schoolyard to see if there's a synagogue below the surface? I says, why not? Why don't we give it a try? At a couple weeks later, Richard Freund's giving a talk in St. Louis, and a representative from the State Department's there, and he's talking about this idea that what we are doing in Rhodes and the idea that potentially we could take a look at this in Lithuania based on our research. And the State Department says, how much money do you need to go? You're on the border with Russia. We're interested in funding science and sharing the science that we have in the United States to go there. You're working with undergraduate students. And we just put a low budget in to take a couple students ourselves over to work with Vilnius University, to take work with the Institute of Lithuanian History, and to take a look at what we could do at that site. And so it's just serendipitous that these things happened and moved on in those areas. So I don't have to, I have put this in, because often Eau Claire, they go, where even is Lithuania? And even the students, and taking a look at some of these areas is take a look at some of these areas. And so we're taking a look along the Baltic coastline here. We've got Latvia, Estonia to the north, Belarus to the south, which is still under control. John Seligman had traveled these areas. His family originally came from this region, and therefore he was interested in what was going on in these regions. And so let's take a step back. We just talked about the Holocaust and Rhodes. We know that in 1941, there's 220,000 Jews in Lithuania. We know that 90% of the Jews were killed by 1945. in that site, so you can see. And we have to remember that in Lithuania, it was different. This is before we decided to deal on the final solution from the Nazis, right? This is before that situation started taking control in this region. We have to remember that Russia controlled this, and then the Nazis came in, broke that treaty, had moved into the site, and we'll talk about some of the ramifications of that. We've just talked to Father Patrick Dubois. He's based out of France, and they're very much interested in collaborating and potentially using radar, as we'll talk about, to try to solve some of these sites in these areas. So Jews have a long history in Lithuania, and a lot of these background information coming from Richard, coming from John Siegelman in those areas, and basically moving to some of the bigger cities in the 18th, 19th century. It was very vibrant, very extremely well known, and moved into some of those big cities. And the synagogue that we're going to be talking about in the bottom right was that great synagogue of Vilnia, which sat in the heart of Vilnius or Vilnia. It was a combination Jewish synagogue, Jewish community center. You had to show off there with a lot of prayer halls associated with these areas. But for everyone in that community, this was the center in this area. And this is the way it looked in the 1930s. And what you'll notice that peeking out of the top here is the top of a church. And this synagogue and the shul and a lot of the stores associated with that Jewish community are all around this. It's very hard to get a picture here. You didn't have drones back then and things like that. You could go up and take pictures. It's very hard. You'll see this picture used over and over and over again in these areas. But why is this place famous? And particularly a lot of groups are going there. I was talking with the Milwaukee Jewish Association. They're heading off. They thought when they phoned me and said, can you give us a tour of this area? We just heard about what you're doing. We're going to be there in October, in late October, early November. I said, I'm in Wisconsin, right? And I gave them some sites and some connections to go to. Many, many groups were coming by as we were doing our work. And a lot of the reason was the Gaon Vilnia. Essentially, as I try to explain to some people, he would be like the Luther or Calvin to Christianity in the sense of the Reformation that went on, and to Judaism, trying to bring that into the modern period. So many people revere this site, but there is no longer a great synagogue at this location. And this is some of the photos of that area, these study halls and these prayer houses as part of this larger great synagogue, and they were essentially destroyed. They were still, after the Second World War, the synagogue was still there. It wasn't used. It was destroyed a little later, as we'll take a look at a moment. But let's take a step back. Now this is the background I have coming into this project. And flying in with some students, we were there last year, and we were there this past summer. The airport's just located off in this region. I'll be talking about Ponera a little later, that's situated down in that region. It ties somewhat to the airport. And the Vilnius city, which is a very dynamic city, in this region, you arrive in a very Soviet-looking airport. Okay, you come in and still columns and things like that, and now we're dealing with modern day, right? They're trying to change that for that. A lot of planes coming in. It's like some of the older styles we have here in the U.S., where every 20 minutes a plane is landing, you go off by bus, you go back on by bus onto some of these areas. Students arriving, they have no idea what they're getting themselves into, okay? I mean, they're arriving from Western Wisconsin. One guy from Webster, Wisconsin had never been on a plane before, right? His biggest city is Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I just talked with a student and says, those flashing lights, those red lights at night, what do they mean? Because he doesn't even have a stop sign in his own city where he comes from. So we're dealing with this huge dynamics that are going on in these regions. And this is funded through University of Wisconsin's International Fellows Program. We have the students tax themselves through Blue Gold Commitment Grant Differential Tuition, that capitalizes the idea of bringing students overseas. And it's to accelerate that global learning. You have a very strong program here as well. And it's to support the unmet financial need of both faculty and students to do research overseas. And the students have taxed themselves and said, we want to do this. These are the programs that have been to areas all around the world doing research with groups of students anywhere from one, and I usually have the biggest groups, four or five students. In the past, we've had programs go to Israel, with that I've taken, New Zealand, and then I took this group to Lithuania this past summer. It's been a very successful program. It won an national award 2 years ago on a model of international education. And we're continuing this program, and there's continuing funding associated with it. As we all know, the travel, and with the travel situations at UW system, it becomes a little more challenging. But we continue to work with this and attract students who typically would not go on a study abroad program into these regions. I'm going to be concentrating the talk on a couple sites in Vilnius itself, but we did go to places where we looked at Neolithic sites. I was talking with Sarah and the student on the way up, looking at, you know, very pagan location and looking at some of that history, and we're trying to find some of those sites, working with the Lithuanian Institute of History. Also, the coastline, the Baltic coast, has got all kinds of history. Particularly for me, I'm interested in coastline development, be it Lake Superior, be it Lake Michigan, be it the West Coast, East Coast with these hurricanes, but also the Baltic coast has a very, very interesting coastline, and we're imaging into the subsurface and seeing what the changes are in those areas, what's the history, and that's potentially a longer-term project I'm working on with several there. Well, this is Vilnius. Has anyone been to Vilnius here? Couple people, okay. A fascinating city. A year and a half ago, it got the Euro. It is, if you ever get a chance, a stunning medieval city with forts along the rivers. It is a jewel. Here's a look going along the river. This is early morning. I went for an early morning run, take some photos. It's busy during the day. There's no one here because it's really early. And inside the city, as we go through, are thriving markets. You've got the Gate of Dawn, which is the Pope John Paul II went here and visited some of these sites. And so you have all kinds of squares that have been preserved. The Soviets didn't destroy a lot of this area. They're now being preserved. And you're seeing a lot of tourism coming out, a lot of the European markets coming into this area. Beautiful churches that are still preserved that you can go through and take a look at that. But the story we're taking a look at here is one discussing the Great Synagogue of Vilnius. And as we come around our hotel, this is the present and the only remaining, I think the only remaining synagogue. They're trying to restore a couple others in this region. This has active services that are in this area. And as we walk through from this site, we walk into this region. And you can see the buildings are still a little run down in this region. But if you take a look at the windows, these are the families that lived in these houses in the ghettos during the Second World War. This is where the Jewish community was in this region. And so as you walk through this, the students are trying to figure out what's going on, because in the United States, there's still a lot of questions, and how do we teach the Holocaust, and how do we take a look at that, particularly from young students today. This is way over in Lithuania, let alone what's happening in Europe during this time period. You've got plaques on the side of the wall designating these are the ghettos and the regions in this community, and you can see these as you walk through the different locations. This is where the ghetto was, in the sense of, if you take a look at this now, and this is the way it was in the 40s when the Nazis took over this region. And so this would have been the wall that cut off that ghetto in this region. And here you have the whole, basically, downtown Vilnius, and you can see the two blue areas with the ghettos in that region, and where the Jews were basically put into these types of locations. And that came in when the Nazis came through, broke the treaty with the Russians, and the Russians had to move out of this site, basically beating that area. On the 6th of September 1941, the ghettos, they were set up, they were sealed off, and then slowly they were sending groups off to Ponar. We'll talk about that in a moment. And they were doing this until 1943, and essentially they depleted the ghettos in these regions. And taking a look at some of those areas. And so taking a look at the Great Synagogue of Shul Vilnia becomes very important in taking a look at some of these areas. It was the centerpiece, as I mentioned, for the Jewish community at this site. Located in this area, it's quite a large one in this medieval area. And what we can see in here is that these are some of the maps that we've amalgamated, put together with some of our researchers at Vilnius University, as well as others. And what we can see here is that it wasn't just the synagogue here in the middle. We had a whole community around it. We had all kinds of prayer homes, study halls, and things like that. But that's all that remains is the map. What's unique about this site, which we'll play in as we take a look at this, is that because the synagogue height could not be above any of the churches around there, they decided we're going to build down. We're going to build down into the ground so we can still have this massive structure when you go inside of it and be one of the largest buildings in Vilnius, with beautiful frescoes on the ceiling and all these features. Okay. Basically, during the time of the Nazis, they moved people into the ghettos. This area wasn't used. It was used for storage. It was essentially plundered. And then it was finally demolished by the Soviets in 1957, and they built a school, an elementary school, on top of it. And this is the area today as we're walking through it. And this is very different than environments I normally work on, right? Usually there's not buildings and everything associated with that. Here's the kids' playground, the elementary school. We have to start our work after the school year is done, so we don't have people out there on recess and things like that. There are the monkey bars that they would play on. Here's the front yard of the grassed area in these regions. And this is where we're asked to start our ground-penetrating radar survey. In a very urbanized environment, we have no idea what's underneath us. And so we are doing these surveys. The students are learning these techniques as we're doing this. And we continue to collect grids or transects as we move along this area. And here we're in the front yard of the school here. And we've got all kinds of groups coming by asking us what we're doing and things like that. And what we're looking at here is, we're not going to go into the processing, but I'll show you these images. And in these region of these long transects, what we see are right angle turns on surfaces and features in the subsurface. Natural processes don't form these type of landscapes. This is human caused. And so what I do is I pass along to the archaeologists, I say, this is not natural, I would suggest you dig at these sites. And so we continue on with that. Unbeknownst to me is that I was being tested at this first site, and then in 2011 they did excavate down to the site, and they found part of the bemis of the Great Synagogue. And so they know where part of the church is. They excavated down, and so this was my test. Is Joel going to be able to do this? We know where things are. If he surveys here, he should be able to find it. And that's what just showed you the results. But we found a lot more. We found a lot more walls and locations in these regions. And we started getting some more of the maps that we pulled out where they did some of the work. And we continued doing surveys, so long days in the field, and continued to find locations where there are potential walls here, potential other locations in this area. And then we get more maps, because now we are part of this community. I'm saying, did you know about this? Did you remember about the bathhouse? The bathhouse should be really interesting. What about this location? And everything tied to the Schulhof is now part of our dimensions. The yellow area here is a school that now we have placed on top of the synagogue. And we continue to do the surveys, talking with each other. We're trying to locate sites. We're talking with the students. This is always an educational process. We're meeting with people here from Vilnius University. These are professors there. We're developing programs with them. And we're building our maps now. Now we're using GPS and total stations to tie in our survey grids to what we know in the subsurface and try to adjust things and try to see what is in the subsurface. This bathhouse becomes very interesting. This is a bathhouse because it's very interesting because people will just leave things behind. And so these are the grids that we left with last year. This is the major site that I told you earlier for part of the Bema was. We found more walls in this region. But this becomes a target for what we were going to do this summer. And these results, as they're released, are picked up worldwide. Of the Great Synagogue of Vilnius, we know where it is. And now we're taking a look at these locations. The elementary school is willing to move. Okay, to restore the synagogue, the question becomes, where's the funding going to come from, right? There's always a question as we take a look at some of these. We're continued our work. This past summer, this is John Seligman, whose project he's encompassing here, and we start digging on the radar sites of our own excavations. And you can see we're digging down at this site, and NOVA's become very interested in this project. So NOVA's filming real time as we're going through this site. Students are excavating. These are students in different disciplines learning how to excavate. We're meeting the mayors, we're meeting the ambassadors of Israel, a variety of other countries, coming through. We're doing real-time GPR to try to find some of these locations of where they should dig, on where they should locate. We're running more surveys and locations at this site, and they keep on digging down, and we found the locations of the bathhouse. We found a lot of glazed pottery and a lot of these locations, and we've got basically a 10-day permit to excavate, to get things basically started and finished in that 10-day period. Students are finding all kinds of things at these sites. They're part of the whole process. We've got in some of the Israelis that come over and excavate it. We've got people from other universities as well as Vilnius University joining this. Most of the projects are recorded on this website, and feel free to, I can send links and these ideas here. Everything is up on this website that John Seligman with the Israeli Antiquities Authority has released in those areas. Tying to this story, we were asked by the Gaon Vilnius Museum, can you look at a site that is extreme of interest to us? We don't know all the details, but there are many sites around Vilnius. This is just one example where you have buildings with a large Jewish community that were taken over by the Nazis and with mass burials at different sites. You can go to graveyards all around Vilnius and hundreds of grave sites around around Lithuania that were desecrated. These are some of the headstones from previous burials in this region that were found in building rocks around Vilnius after the Second World War. But the big one that we were asked to take a look at was to take a look at Poner. And Poner was a camp where these individuals from these ghettos, as well as others, were sent. And there's all kinds of history that we're putting together as others put together, and we're only a part of this story. There was an individual who wrote every single day of what this individual saw out of his window. And he witnessed every single person coming into the site and not leaving. And he heard the shots, and he recorded it every single day. And so we have this history that's tied with this story. This is the memorial. They're building a new information center as we speak based on some of the results. There's a huge memorial, Jewish memorial. There's also memorials to other individuals because of the 100,000 people that were killed at this site. 70,000 were Jews at this location, as well as a lot of others that were killed that were the Nazis wanted to have removed from this site. And this is a very tough story for students. They are now at a site where 100,000 people were killed, and now we're going to try to find those localities and some of the details at this site. The significance of what we're doing is now hitting upon as we go through. We're introduced to these sites by the local staff. John Seligman here in the front. We've done several ceremonies, particularly for the ones who passed away before, and he tells us during this time period that several of his family members were killed at this camp. So now it's not a larger story, it's personal. It's part of our team. These are the pits, and the Soviets, when they came into the site, were developed at the airport, and they said, we need fuel storage pits for our airplanes. And so they dig these huge pits to go around and started to build them up. The Nazis came in after this, right? And they said, basically left this, and they said, this is a wonderful place to execute people without anyone knowing about it, because this is in the middle of a forest, okay? And so you have these multiple pits. We don't know how many pits there were exactly, okay? And so we're trying to find that out as we take a look at these sites. We've gathered LIDAR data to try to find out if we can see the depressions into the subsurface. We have, going back into 1944 when the German Luftwaffe was filming these areas just before the Battle of Vilnius in 1944, and so we have the Luftwaffe visual and the Israeli Air Force is now dissecting these images to see what we can pull out. Are there other pits that we want to take a look at? We've got drone imagery. Part of our team is flying drones at the site to see what we can fly among this dense forest, and you can see on the right-hand side, this is us shooting ground-penetrating radar, and it's not an easy thing to go through this site and take a look at some of these areas. But what you can see from the drone imagery, you got these railway tracks right beside it. You got some of the pits here, and what's the concern is these railway tracks, we want to make sure that they don't hit any pits as they expand. We want to make sure we preserve this area and figure out where those pits are as we take a look at that. Working with our team, this is electrical resistivity tomography. It sends electrical signals into the ground, and we're looking at that electrical pulses that are moving through and the resistivity of the ground. And using this imagery, we can cover a lot of 2D imageries quite well. This is Paul Bowman and Alistair McClick. And what they do is brought into this area, and what you can see here is that the purple area is very different than where it's designated as a pit. And we're trying to find this location. Originally, they said it was over in this region here. This is the depression. This is a digital elevation model. They thought it was over here. They shot there and didn't find anything, but they said, let's continue over here. And they found a portion of that pit. And then they shot multiple lines, what we call a star pattern on this site, to figure out exactly where these areas are. We can put this in all the kinds of 3D imagery and figure out where that pit locality is. And I am going to show you from a line here with radar that we shot. We were located in this area, and we're presently working on a 3D grid of that site as we go through. But you can see that pit on the left-hand side. It's all purple. That, to me, is very sandy material. This is a wind-blown dune field. If you've ever been in dunes, this is what this area is like. And a forest is growing up on top of it, on top of this area. And so what we see on the where the yellow region of this long line is horizontal layering or sub-horizontal layering in the subsurface. This is what I expect in these sand sheets in this region. This is normal. This is what we would expect into the sub in these areas. Then we get these, and I showed you some of this earlier. We're seeing these cross cuts coming in and moving into here that's eroded out some of these horizontal layers. And we know in most aeolian landscapes, we usually don't get that erosional truncation going on. It's usually dunes building up or grading in these environments. And this is exactly where those pits were designated. So this is where the Soviets would originally cut out these pits in this location. And in there, as we move further into the pit, this is this chaotic material. When the Soviets, when the people would come into this area, they would go along a processing trench. I'll just show you in a moment. They'd be brought out to one of these pits, and by groups of 5 to 10 would be shot as a group. They would fall into the pit, and then the next group would come into this site. And this is that processing pit. Processing trench. We've done some earlier work at Sobibor in Poland, and as you go along these trenches and try to locate these areas, people knew they were going to die. And so what they did is they took off their jewelry, they took off any mementos, and hid them in the sides, hoping that someone would come back later on to dig to find those and return it to family members. Right? So, but the problem at this site, it had been moved, things had been moved around, and so the question is, where are some of these processing trenches where people would have moved along? And can we preserve those in these areas? And so we were directed to a certain grid, and again, these sites are where we've been asked to work in. And what we can see is from the ERT, it's a very shallow. This is undisturbed sand, but there are some disturbances up top. And with radar, we can see some more of the details. We can see the fill on top, but this oval-shaped feature where I've got the yellow around are what we interpreting as a trench. And then from there, if we do some plan views or 3D imagery, we can see some of the trench locations here. And this is what we've passed on to Poner and said, if you want to excavate, this is our suggestions and these are our sites for that area. To finish off, looking at not a pleasant time in history, and that's why I titled it Horror, and this is part of that hope of where we can go. In 1943 and later, we realized, the Soviet Nazis realized they were not going to win. And they also realized that they had to get rid of the evidence of this massive killing. And so what they started doing is putting these burning brigades together. And at this site, they put together 80 males and females, Jewish males and females, whose direction was to dig up everyone that had been shot over the previous years and burn them, okay, at this site. This is an example of, well, this is one of the pits, but this little bridge that you see here was where you would have to lift the bodies and carry them out and then put them on the piles to be burned. And so that is a recreation of this site. the 80 individuals whose duty it was to do the, to basically to dig up these individuals and bury them, were in this pit right here. They were in a barracks facility, and so they only a couple people control them because they were down below. They'd be sleeping in barracks. And they realized that they were going to be killed. At end of story, they realized that. And so what they did is, okay, they're finding artifacts and things off the bodies and things like that, and they were using some of their cups. They were still in shackles. They were all shackled as they were doing this. And they decided, one of the engineers in the group said, let's build a tunnel. Let's try to figure this out. Let's try to get out of here. And so they were digging all through the night in a hole roughly, right, our body length, roughly, you know, a couple feet by a couple feet. And it was in sandy material. And if you ever try to dig in sandy material, it collapses and collapses. And so they were using whatever structures they could get to build that up in this site. And so this is a schematic of that tunnel. The tunnel was 100 feet long, 30 meters long when it was finished. And what they did is that they 80 of them were building this over the years. On Passover, which was going to be the darkest night of the year, they had planned for the darkest night of the year, which just so happened to be Passover. And they were, that was going to be their evening out. And as they were going out, roughly about 20 to 40 of them were getting out. And because they had their shackles and had to break that off before they could run, the Nazis heard the noise and started shooting. Out of those 80 that were in there, and roughly about 30 to 40 that got out of the tunnel, 12 escaped. 11 survived that escape. And to this day, we can take a look at some of the stories. It's the only reason we know this happened is because of those stories as we go through. It's always been of interest to find that tunnel because it is, in all this horror, something of hope, and that's out there. And so in 2004, you had a group that found the actual tunnel where it started in that pit, and they could realize that there was some collapse and some structures. We did not get these photos until we did our work this summer. So these are the first time I've seen these images until a couple days ago. This individual and a group did some ground penetrating radar work in 2004, as well as some excavations, and said, here are some potential directions for this tunnels in these areas. And so Ken Bennison, who's worked with us in other tunnel sites, such as Bethsaida that I mentioned earlier, said, here are the rough directions. They were looking for low ground, because if you're going to escape, you need to be in low ground. So they're trying to build the tunnel in those areas. There's talks of, as they're excavating, running into bodies, or realizing, oh no, they built a watchtower there, we gotta move the tunnel a little. So all these complications come in. And so the electrical resistivity tomography looked for some of these sites. So these guys were in about a week and a half before I got there. And they found in this resistive areas, these more conductive areas. So the idea is they found this at several different sites along this location and linked these up, and it tied into where the tunnel was. And so they continued on that and potentially finding some buried metal objects which might be associated with the shackles or with cups or things that they may have found in that region. And this is where this low area where that potentially is, that escape area of that where the tunnel came out in that location. When we arrived on site, this is what it looks at. We were said we want a grid located over that site. And so this is that grid. We knew where Paul Bowman's hits were for those tunnels. But this again is a very complex area. We know that there's been a lot going on in subsurface. These are some of the images. And what we're trying to do here is look for the regular stratigraphy, so you can see the pink lines here are essentially what we'd expect in this type of natural environment. And then we have human influences. You've got electrical lines through here. You've got asphalt pavements moving through here to get tourists through. And what we're doing is trying to find things that were not linked to features that we knew were on the landscape and that were tied to the electrical resistivity tomography. These are electrical lines that we can pick up, but this is what we think are what's some of the results of these tunnels. We don't think that they're still whole. We believe that they were collapsed, and therefore they're holding some more moisture in that area, and that we're seeing some differences. And so this becomes at those elevations that were predicted of what we think some of those tunnels are at those sites. Nova was filming us real time and released, as well as with the New York Times, which essentially went around the world. This was the second leading, as I was told, second leading news story after the Istanbul bombings at the airport at that time period. And so this was, from taking a look at this locations, we're doing this the same time as we're continuing our other excavations. And so let's pull back at this fascinating story of locating a tunnel. The students are finishing up. It's our last couple days. We're digging at the site, and this woman walks up. And this is a woman who still has a, lives in the Jewish community still. And she starts talking with us because she hears that we're excavating at Shulam. She says, I remember the Great Synagogue of Shulam. I remember the ghettos. I was passing messages to the partisans. I was going out at night delivering messages and coming back. And when she came back one day, the ghetto was empty. There was no one left in the ghetto. And so she went back out to live with the partisans. And she says, I just heard on the news that you found the tunnel. She says, I just want to let you know, I met those individuals at that site. Sorry. She told the story and then had to leave because it was too much. Just like Schindler's List, a lot of people found out about the history. And the summer they filmed all the descendants that wanted to meet together of the survivors of the story. So I encourage you next April to, we couldn't get this up and running, but for those who wanted, we can play it on the laptop later. Nova's filmed this, has a release. It'll be coming out next April. They're interested, of course, in the science. And what we're trying to do is trying to use science, use radar, use ERT, to try to tell the Holocaust story. Because we know in the next couple years, there will not be many survivors, if any, left. And we believe that science can continue to tell the story as we go through. Thank you.
We have some time for questions.
Yeah.
Can you
sure
handle your own?
Sure.
Calling
not a problem.
People? Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Well, first, let me just thank you for this fantastic presentation. Just stunning and just so interesting and important. So I have a question for you, which is about the support of the Lithuanian government in this endeavor. Because one of the things I noticed is you said you had 10 days to excavate.
Yeah.
And so let me just share one anecdote. I went to Vilnius in 1993, and I was studying Russian in St. Petersburg, and I went, and I just happened to stay with a woman. And this woman was a Lithuanian woman, and she said, well, since you're American, I'll speak to you in Russian, and I'm just going to tell you two things. She said, I'm going to tell you two things. The two things are, first of all, Jews were killed here before the Nazis came.
Correct.
And the second thing is that this synagogue was destroyed by the Soviets.
Correct.
And she said, so whatever you're hearing, the story is more complicated than it's going to seem like. So just remember that, which I, you know, I did. I was 22 years old, but it stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I just found this person so interesting. But I, at that time, there were secret informal museums of the Holocaust in the Baltics, mm-hmm. not just in Lithuania. So I always have been interested in the way the governments of the Baltic states support this kind of work or not. So I guess that's a long question, but I'm just curious about the way the government of Lithuania now is dealing with this.
It is a dynamic situation. They're now part of the EU and very much adopting a lot of those principles. But this is a checkered history. When that woman came, right at the last day, as we were cleaning up, just totally serendipitous, no one knew what questions to ask, right, as she came in. When she walked away, John Seligman says, you know, the liberation came in time. Montas, who was one of the excavators, said, I'm offended by your comment. When the Soviets came, that was... Right? Not that the Germans were any better. When the Soviets came, that was not a liberation day for us. So what was a liberation, let's say, for the Jews was not a liberation for the Lithuanians. Mm-hmm. And so you got to be very careful on how you talk about these situations. We have to remember the Soviets, I mean, we have to remember that the Nazis, the SS, used the Lithuanian Rifle Association to kill the Jews, as they did in many different sites, which is a difficult story, right? I went to the KGB museum that's in Vilnius this year. That was a difficult thing to go through, right? But this is a complicated history, as you're alluding to. I mean, it's not an easy story. There's all kinds of mixtures going on in here. And a guy who studies, shorelines and Lake Superior and things, I'm getting involved in the middle of this. And that's where we're saying, let's see what the science shows. Let's take a look at this. And we're trying to have as multi-purpose group as possible, getting everyone involved. The lead ex-archaeologist on site, who's a Lithuanian, basically is Russian-Lithuanian. Montas, who's a new PhD candidate, is English-Lithuanian, and so he's basically going from us, English, going through Lithuanian to Russian, and then going up and down. And so the students are seeing those dynamics real time as we're going through in the sites. So it is a difficult history, and I'm still learning. I changed some of my text today based on some things that I learned.
Yeah. Holding up on the storytelling, what comes to mind is, of course, Katyn.
And what?
Well, it was during the war, it was clearly said Russians did it, but after that, the story was told, no, the Nazis did it.
Right. And you have, and this is where, as we go through, what is the... How are we going to figure out this story? What is the science? What is the literature going to show us? So, yeah.
Thank you so much. That was a fascinating presentation. I'm just curious, what was the background knowledge of the Holocaust for the students that you traveled with, and how did this experience transform the way that they understood the history, but also themselves as millennials studying in such a dark time in history?
I think they didn't know what they were getting themselves into. I don't think I had a lot for myself working with this group. It's every step I walk, roads is a similar thing. I walked in what I thought was going to be relatively all kinds of history that's tied into this. And I took students along with that. And I think from a student's perspective, let's go study abroad. Let's go take a look at these sites. And I teach them how to use the tools, and everyone's working. You see everyone's using the tools. Everyone's collecting the data. And they all have different parts, different reflections as we go through, but it continuously was of, as they were meeting these individuals, and I think the woman at the end tops it off of, this is real, this happened, how did it happen, and how can we as humans basically allow these things to happen and so evil, and how do we move ahead from this? And James, who, small town Wisconsin, right? He was Wisconsin Public Radio that the interview was on. And Kate, the interviewer, says, so what really struck you? And I had no idea what was going to go on. And that pit, where we were trying to find that pit with radar, and he had been using radar at a variety of different sites, and all of a sudden it was a realization for him as he was walking along to see that edge of the pit. And then probably what you're seeing in that subsurface is the remains of potentially, thousands of individuals who have been burned at that site. There is no intention to excavate there. That is not our intention. The idea is we want to block off this area so the railway doesn't go through. We want to block off these areas and say where this occurs. What we would like is potentially to excavate part of that tunnel to say, this is a true story, here it is, and this is the reality of that. And I think a follow-up to your question, which was interesting, I lead field trips to seminars to Yosemite. And we had a couple was coming by, and we had all kinds of groups asking questions, and we'd stop our work, we're explaining what we're doing, and she goes, her husband was Jewish, and she wanted, they were at this site to go through that, they're from the U.S., and she says, well, I'm Native, and Native American, and we started talking about some of that. She says, I remember my elders talking about a similar situation near Yosemite. And the idea that the natives were brought off to these pits and were killed at this site. And that just tied it full circle to, we live here, and she and that person had been on that field trip to Yosemite. And they could see that it wasn't just over there, it's also back at home. And so how do we move forward, I think, is the big question. And we can move forward. There is hope. These families that you saw in Israel are living that hope. As we go through. Yeah.
There was one group of victims, which hasn't been mentioned yet, at Ponari. These are the Poles.
Correct.
Also Soviet prisoners of war.
Correct.
And Vilna was very much a Polish city.
Yes,
during
was.
The war period.
Correct.
The capital of Lithuania was Kaunas.
Yes.
And of course the Poles were expelled by the coming Soviet army. And I wonder to which side the Jews who remained in the survived the Holocaust were inclined. Were they siding with the Poles, who were the masters before the war? Their culture was called Yiddish. Was their second language Polish or Lithuanian or Russian or German?
Well, I think it depends on the communities you're at, because we did talk to people who had Polish background, Belarus background, and so it depended on those communities, because John Seligman went to, part of his family was in Belarus, and so they would speak, part of his family spoke Pole. Because of this history that's in this region. And so I think that's a fascinating study. What were the cultural dynamics back then as they were going through? And every, you know, these conversations as we get academics together, but also as we get these families together of what is this mixture that's going on here? And it's only because more recently with opening up with the EU that a lot of these stories can come out and we can talk about these issues a lot more. The sad thing is most of the youth are leaving Lithuania because they see the rest of Europe as this big attraction, just like, you know, the Midwest, New York or LA is this big attraction. You know, London is this big attraction. Paris is this big attraction where they want to go to. And they're seeing a population decline. And when I talk to Montas, who's a PhD candidate, he says, I'm staying. He says he's been to Atlanta. He's done all these things, but he wants to help his country grow and develop. And that's why we plan to go back next summer. So if anyone's interested, we're going back next summer. We're continuing our work at Ponar, at the synagogue, as well as you mentioned Kaunas. You have the exact same story there. And we've been just invited 2 days ago. I just got an email on the way down. We've been invited to take a look at some of those mass killing sites as well, looking at the similar things that we're doing here. And so we're literally planning out things as we're moving forward. Yes.
Since you brought up the topic of Native Americans, you're probably aware that locally that Native Americans are using this type of technology to research the mounds. There's many mounds in Dane County, and they're using those as a non-invasive way of finding out what types of artifacts are down there.
Yes. Yeah, we've worked with the Ho-Chunk as well as other groups over the last 20 years. And we've got Lake Kosinong, as well as some other areas. We did some original work and then passed along those tool sets there. And so, again, this provides a non-invasive, non-destructive technology into the subsurface, which is not always accepted, right? And the question is, these are sacred sites. We worked at the military base, and the question is, are these burial mounds or not? And that's not I'm not answering that question.
Which military base?
Up Toma. Okay, Fort McCoy.
Okay.
And we were asked to take a look at those. Those are probably windblown dunes. Those are probably windblown dunes, but they're still sacred sites. And so we were asked to take a look at that. We didn't find any long enough to be bodies. Essentially what we found is probably looters' bits, that people would go into those and loot if they found anything, and often they didn't in those sites. But Fort McCoy exchanged that property. They just said, that's sacred, we'll exchange property. That's yours, and we'll move those into those different sites. So it is one of these tools. It's not 100%. And again, it is not easy to, you've got to understand the context when you're interpreting them. We've shot several of these burial mounds and effigy mounds, and there are different stories in each one.